Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hey, this is Michael Greenberg from RAND calling in.
Yes, this is Imadeddin Ahmed, the speaker.
Oh, how do you do? Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I guess we're a little bit early.
Well, I was asked to be on early for obvious reasons.
Yes. I assume John Baskin will join us soon.
Yeah, I expected he'd be on by now, but...
No. I'm going to put my phone on mute just for a few minutes.
Sure, right.
Hello to those of you on the line. You are listening to the Intangible Asset Finance Society Mission Intangible Monthly Briefing for February 2014. We're not starting yet. We'll start at the top of the hour. I just wanted you to know that we're here and we are gearing up for the show. Dr. Ahmad, are you with us on the line?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good morning. Dr. Greenberg, are you here as well?
Yes, I am.
God, I feel like I'm visiting a medical office. remind to both of my guests, we're live on this line, so all of our listeners can listen in. So let's keep ourselves muted. And again, I will kick things off at the top of the hour, and I'm really looking forward to our chat. So thank you both for showing up. Welcome, everyone, to the Intangible Asset Finance Society Mission Intangible Monthly Briefing for February 2014. I'm your moderator, Jonathan Salem Baskin, and on behalf of the Society, I want to thank everyone for joining us today. Now, when I come to think of it, all human systems for governance are based on fundamental beliefs. Laws, courts, regulations, and the mechanisms by which administrative decisions are made trace their origins to the same sources that give us our definitions of truth, of righteousness, or how to live good lives. So it's no surprise that concepts like fairness or accountability or ownership that underline any definition of intellectual property or other intangible assets are, in many ways, inseparable from our spiritual understanding of those terms. Whether referenced overtly or simply contextually, religion is inescapable in our secular lives, however we might claim or want to think otherwise. The rub, of course, is that the peoples of planet Earth come from different religious contexts. Though there is immense commonality of theme and intent across the world's great religions, perhaps because they're products of different peoples in different times trying to translate the same truths, the holy books and the words they contain are not identical. Further, unlike the prescriptions and encouragements of ritual or morality, they are not complete and therefore require our interpretation. For instance, though the prohibition on committing murder that leads the Ten Commandments translates easily into jurisprudence, the lines in America's Declaration of Independence about all men being created equal and that a creator has endowed us all with inalienable rights, like pursuing happiness, are a bit more speculative, or perhaps more the result of a community's consensus opinion. Similarly, the Quran is very easy to follow when it comes to defining secular laws on topics such as inheritance, but there's room for interpretation by civil authorities on issues like a woman's right to drive a car. This human activity of interpretation that yields jurisprudence is called fiqh in Arabic and common law generally in Western cultures. It is important that we both respect the foundations of these activities while striving to understand how and why they're applied. This is especially true in a world connected ever more closely by commerce and the Internet. The Quran has no chapter on digital rights management, nor the Bible provide any verse explaining patents. Intangible assets seem almost preordained to be an area of complexity and diverse interpretations. Yet those eternal sources of truth upon which we rely have conveniently left it up to us, we briefly temporal beings, to come up with the answers. Now, thankfully, we have with us today two experts who can help us better understand the role of fiqh when it comes to intellectual property in countries that derive their beliefs from the Quran and how it might differ or not from Western regulatory frameworks. And please remember that no two countries, regardless of their holy book of choice, have identical schemes in place. Now, with us today is Dr. Imad ad-Din Ahmad, the president of the Minaret of Freedom Institute, an Islamic think tank, and Dr. Michael Greenberg, RAND Corporation, and also a member of the Society's Reputation Leadership Council. Dr. Ahmad, welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. And Dr. Greenberg, welcome to you too.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
And as I said, as we were setting up this call, this is sort of the moment that my mom wanted me to avoid when she said, go to medical school. With that said, and before we get to our conversation, I do want to ask for the two of your indulgence so I can get a little background and housekeeping out of the way. The Intangible Asset Finance Society, which you can find at www.iafinance.org, is the premier trusted and authoritative global resource for executives seeking to improve their company's financial performances with better intangible asset management. The Society's mission is to enable our professional members to implement integrated, enterprise-wide strategies that foster a more ethical and innovative business culture, increase the quality, safety, sustainability, and security of goods and services, and thereby enhance reputations. The Mission Intangible Monthly Briefing broadcast is a free service by the Society. Recordings of our programs are available for purchase from our store, which you'll find on our site. And as always, we have a global audience with us today. So our guests and our participants hail from all over the world and across most of the U.S. time zone. So to those of you on the line, again, good morning or good afternoon or good evening. Now, if you're in the audience, and though you can't contribute verbally to the conversation here, you can participate, and you're invited to submit questions during the program, which I will then pose to the speakers. And the email address for those questions is questions@iafinance.org. Okay, enough with the commercial. To start us off, I'd like to give each of our guests about 5 minutes or so just to better introduce themselves and, if anything, tell us what's top of mind these days for them or just give us a better understanding of how they come to this issue, particularly other than having been invited to be on the show. Dr. Ahmad, do you want to kick us off with a little bit more about you?
Sure. First, I have to admit that my PhD, it's not an MD, is not in Islamic studies nor in finance, but in astrophysics. I switched over into the field of Islamic studies in the 1980s when I felt that the Islamic revolution in Iran had demonstrated that the so-called experts on Islam didn't seem to know what they were talking about. And so as a lifelong Muslim practitioner, observer, and as a someone with a deep interest in the social sciences, I switched fields. And in the early 1990s, founded the Minaret of Freedom Institute, which is an Islamic think tank, a policy research organization, and which can be seen online at minaret.org. Our special interest at the Minaret of Freedom Institute is issues of liberty and property rights. And so although I'm not really an expert in intellectual property rights, nonetheless, I'm hoping that my background in the general issues of how Islamic law works, how the jurisprudence is developed, how it applies to general issues of property rights, could give a background in which can be helpful to a discussion of intellectual property rights in particular.
Well, that's very helpful. And I understand also you've run for political office. Is that correct?
That's correct. I ran for the office of U.S. Senate as Libertarian Party candidate in the most recent election here in Maryland.
That's great. What a diverse background. So thank you. And Dr. Greenberg, please affirm to everybody that you are not a practicing medical doctor. Or are you?
That is correct, Jonathan. I am not a medical doctor, and also not an Islamic studies expert either. My background is as a psychologist and as a lawyer. I work for the RAND Corporation, have been there for more than a decade, basically doing a range of different kinds of empirical scholarship bearing on policy, particularly at the interface between law and business. I'm responsible for RAND Center for Corporate Ethics and Governance. And in that role, I'm interested in a bunch of different issues touching on intangible assets, touching on reputation, and touching on intellectual property. I think one of the hats that I wear at RAND is as one of the point people who's responsible for thinking about intellectual property issues that funnel out of our work. So I do spend some of my time kind of in a very practical way thinking about problems in patent and licensing and commercialization and how do those sorts of things impact on my organization. So one of the sort of perspectives that I bring to this discussion is that sort of practitioner-oriented perspective. What do I need to understand about how intellectual property law might operate in the Islamic world, assuming that I was potentially interested in doing business there? But I think the thing that interests me more and that I'd like to learn more about is the sort of underlying conceptual foundation for thinking about intellectual property law that exists from an Islamic perspective. Because if you think about the contours of IP law here in the United States, and you sort of move away from trying to understand all the technical details having to do with things like patents or copyrights, what you get to is a notion that, as a society, we think that there is social value in making sure that the rights of authors and inventors and other creative people who generate new and innovative ideas, we think there's social value in protecting that. Because when people have an incentive to innovate and to create, it makes everybody better off. And that underlying rationale is deeply wrapped up in the system that we've established that actually defines what intellectual property rights are, and that sort of establishes how we protect them. And I think, you know, one of the basic questions that I'm hoping we can explore today is how similar or different is it in the Islamic world, that underlying fundamental rationale for what it is that we're trying to protect and why, and whether or not that's shared or not shared, And to the extent it's not shared, how can we reconcile and bridge the intellectual divide between the West and the Islamic world?
Well, that's a great tee up, actually. Thank you, and that's a great tee up to our conversation today. And I'm going to get to that after. I want to ask Dr. Ahmad a first question, which is really more just for our listeners and truly for my education. And Dr. Ahmad, before I get to that thought from Dr. Greenberg, could you just, you know, we here in the U.S., you know, we all watch the same television stations, we hear somewhat a fair amount about Sharia law, and little of it is informed or particularly useful in terms of how we are led to understand, or perhaps purposely led to not understand it through our media here. Can you just give our listeners sort of a brief definitional understanding of Sharia, and then its relationship to fiqh? Because I know, at least on the latter term, that's probably a new term for many of our listeners.
Yes, definitely. Let me start by saying that the word Sharia, which is usually used as a synonym for Islamic law, it does not literally mean Islamic law. The word appears in that form only once in the Quran. Now, there are cognates to the word that appear elsewhere in the Quran, but the word Sharia itself appears once in a verse where translators often translate it as an open way. In it, the God says that he has created for man a Sharia, or an open way to get to the objectives that God has set out for mankind, of which, in this context, the most important objective is justice. So Sharia is, in this context, kind of a concept of the rule of law. And the reason I say this is the literal meaning of the word Sharia is the path to the water. And it may seem very, very strange to people not from the Muslim world and not Arab-speaking as to why a word that literally means the path to the water should become a synonym for Islamic law. But it is actually not so strange if you think about it in the following way. The laws of social sciences, the laws that dictate human interactions, the divine law from the viewpoint of the Islamic worldview is created by God. And in that sense, it's sort of analogous to the view of natural law in the Western legal philosophy as something that is a given and which is not to be invented by man, but rather discovered by man. And that the fiqh, or the jurisprudence, which are the human attempt to understand what the divine law is analogous to the work of scientists who try to struggle to understand the natural law. Natural law is a given. The scientist invents models for how natural law works. And so the same thing is said about the legal sciences in Islamic thought. And that's what the fiqh is about. It's about the legal science in which jurists, who are legal scholars, try to study both the revealed text of the Quran, the practice of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which is called the Sunnah, and also the sciences, the social sciences of economics and so on, in order to understand what is God's will for how men should interact with one another. Their decisions, their rulings, form the corpus of the fiqh. The scholars who engage in that critical thinking in order to derive the fiqh are called the mujtahids. The word mujtahid means one who struggles to understand. And it comes from the same root, interestingly, as the word jihad, a word which is mistranslated as holy war, but simply means struggle. A jihad is any kind of struggle. And one of the struggles that Muslims engage in on the intellectual level is this scholarship in order to understand the law. So that's very simply put. We have on the one side God's ideal of the rule of law, which he is an open way for mankind to achieve the good things in this life and the next from the Muslim point of view that men want. And we have the fiqh as the human attempt to understand, articulate, and to map that law out And if we can understand that distinction, then a lot of what I'm going to say will make a lot of sense. I would add just one more thing, if it's not going into too much detail, and that is to say that the sources of the fiqh, what are called usul al-fiqh, or foundations of the jurisprudence in Islam, are primarily four. The Quran, of course, because for Muslims that is God's word. The Sunnah, because that is how the Prophet Muhammad himself and his companions applied God's word in their own life and form an example for us to follow. A consensus, which can mean either consensus of the scholars or of the early community or of the present community. That's debated among Muslims. But the idea is that if you have all Muslims agreeing that the law is something, then that becomes part of the law. And then finally, ijtihad, which I mentioned before, is what the mujtahids do. It is that original critical thinking that scholars produce from a toolbox of techniques that are available to them. And I will be getting into that toolbox of techniques later.
Cool. Thank you. And just again, for my information, so the interpreters of the fiqh are legal scholars or lawyers versus theologians, correct?
Yes, we would say jurists.
Okay.
Of course, one has to realize that in the classical, and this is maybe an important point worth mentioning, in the what's called the golden era of Islam, from the time of the Prophet up until maybe the 15th or 16th century, the Muslim scholars tended to be what we in the West call Renaissance men. Theologians were also legal scholars, and they were also often scientists. And so you could look at someone like, say, a figure famous in the West would be Omar Khayyam. Westerners know him mainly as a poet, but the fact is he was also an astronomer, he was also a jurist, and he was also a Sufi mystic.
Got it. And also then, just so the fiqh is an evolving set of interpretations and framework for jurisprudence, correct? It is not, I understand the part about assessing and understanding, if you will, the pattern and the laws that are natural around us, but the fiqh is evolving, correct? I mean, much like common law.
It evolves, but so does our understanding of the laws around us. I mean, astronomer, I like to point out the analogy with gravity. To Aristotle, gravity was the tendency of everything to want to be at the center of the universe. To Newton, it's a mutual attraction between any two objects. To Einstein, it's the curvature of space. These are very, very different conceptions of gravity. But gravity is and always was and always will be whatever God decreed it to be. This is just our human attempt to understand it.
Got it. Well, so thank you. And so then to sort of repose Dr. Greenberg's great question at the introduction, this premise that there are some interpretations in the of natural law in the Western canon, and whether they are interpretive from the Bible or in the instance of all men being created equal, which I think was something the founding fathers borrowed from Hobbes. So there are these assumptions, these beliefs that initiative and personal responsibility and ownership rights are key to driving economic and then social growth. And in the Western canon, those two qualities of human experience are sometimes considered one and the same. Financial success is the key to happiness, and happiness yields to financial success. So they're sort of two sides of the same coin, and therefore they are codified into the IP framework, at least in the United States. Is there a similar codification in fiqh specific to intellectual property, or more generally to the sense of individual ownership of anything, whether it's intangible or tangible? Is there that same mechanism or that same understanding, that same acknowledgement of what the West sees as an inherent pattern in the universe? Is that similarly perceived and then translated into fiqh in Islamic countries? And if not, why? What is the core fundamental idea instead? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead, sir.
On the issue of of the role of property, that is very firmly established in the FIC. As a matter of fact, there is a concept of the higher purposes of the law that is used to determine, you know, what the purposes of any legal code should be. And a number of those purposes have been identified by the classical scholars, traditionally five: the rights to life, property, intellect, religion, and lineage, or family or dignity. It's stated a little differently by different scholars. But these five principles must be higher objectives of the law that are served by the law, or the law doesn't serve its purpose. And the inclusion of property is not controversial. It's uniformly accepted. The question arises of what constitutes property. And here, where material property is well understood and that the rules about it are actually very, very similar to Western understandings, when it comes to intellectual property, there has been more of a debate in the Muslim world. I'm actually sure philosophically there's been more of a debate, because I've seen similar debates conducted among Westerners, but in the West it has not prevailed. Those who have argued against, for example, patents and copyrights have tended not to prevail. One has to be aware of one other thing historically that's important here, that Islamic, the fiqh, influenced the law in Muslim countries throughout the classical era. But in recent centuries, when the Muslim world was colonized and occupied by Western nations, a disconnect occurred between the fiqh and between the actual laws that we see in the statutory codes. And when you look at the statutory codes of the Muslim world today, in many cases what you're going to find is some kind of a hybrid, a creolization of whatever the legal system of the previous occupying power was, and some very vague, unfortunately not very well thought out, notion of what Islamic law ought to be. So what we're going to find when we get to the issue of intellectual property rights is it's going to vary very, very dramatically from one country to another.
Well, that makes sense. Dr. Greenberg, do you want to add a question to that, or can I ask you a different one? I want to encourage the two of you to talk freely with each other. But if there's not a direct question you have based on Dr. Ahmad's point, I'm happy to ask you a different one.
I actually do have a couple of clarifying questions, and Dr.
Yeah,
Ahmad,
fire away.
Again, I'm very much in the same position as Jonathan in wanting to learn more. One of the things you just said that struck me was in talking about the way that different statutory regimes have evolved in different Islamic countries that to some degree reflect a mix of some interpretation of Islamic law principles, but also the residue of whatever colonial framework had been in place from centuries earlier. So in thinking about a topic like intellectual property law, what is the relationship between the Islamic law framework that we've been talking about and I guess what we might call civil law institutions that would be tied to state authority in particular countries? Are those things two separate side-by-side systems, or do they blend and intermediate with each other? How does that work?
Yeah. Well, again, in the classical era, the religious scholars or the legal scholars who articulated the law were not officially part of the government. So you had a rather radical form of separation of powers, in which great historian Guettin referred to as having a republic of scholars who articulated the law and wrote it down, and then you had the official rulers of the country who were technically responsible for implementing it, but may or may not have implemented it as as they wish. There was always a tension between the government and these scholars who were more akin to law professors than to legislators, because they never viewed their job as inventing law, but simply on articulating a divinely given law. In the modern world, what's happened is, and it varies depending on, again, on which country you're talking about, in most of the Muslim world, what you have are secular regimes that basically took over the institution of powers that were left in place by colonial powers that had been in there previously, and then to one degree or another made revisions, either gradually or suddenly. For example, in the case of Pakistan, they rewrote the law, but when you study the Pakistani law, you see it's very clearly a hybrid of British law and a particular interpretation of Islamic law that was prominent in Pakistan at the time that the that independence was gained. When you go to Turkey, on the other hand, which was never really occupied, you see, however, that basically that the pre-existing Ottoman law was totally rejected by Ataturk, who put in his own conception of a civil code, secular civil code, inspired largely by French law. And then you can find all kinds of things in between. In Saudi Arabia, you have a rather unusual case in which and here I have to mention something that I didn't get a chance to mention before. I talked about how the mujtahids articulated the law during the classical era. During the modern era, there was a lack of ijtihad, a lack of original scholarship, and the law lost its flexibility. That has been referred to by Western scholars as the closing of the door to ijtihad, and it reflects that tension that was always between the rulers and the scholars, that eventually, after many centuries of the scholars having a lot of influence simply because of their popularity among the masses, after the Mongols took over the eastern half of the Muslim world and hired the scholars to work for the government, once the scholars became agents of the state, they began to rubber stamp whatever the state wanted to do, and they lost the respect of the public, and the public began to feel that there were no scholars worthy of engaging in ijtihad. In the recent modern era, since the 18th century, there's been an attempt to revitalize ijtihad, and one of the first of the mujtahids of the modern era was Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab of Saudi Arabia, who came up with his own interpretation of the law, breaking dramatically from the classical interpretations and attempting, in his eyes, to go back to the original, what he called the Salaf, the original companions of the Prophet, what he felt was their understanding of the law, and coming up with an extremely conservative understanding. Other Salafis who have been at a more modern interpretations of the law have been people like Muhammad Abdu of Egypt, who have actually modernized the law by saying we're going to go back to the original principles of the law and restore the flexibility that existed during the classical era. So you have in Saudi Arabia this very, very conservative interpretation of the law, and in other parts of the world you have scholars who are trying to modernize the law. So basically you have this interaction between the state and the scholars, and it is really different from one country to another.
But Dr. Ahmad, this is Jonathan. Is there a broad or apparent difference between, and by the way, this is a question from a listener, is there a broad or readily apparent difference in the fix between Sunni and Shia in Islam, or is that not a dividing definition in terms of how IP specifically is understood?
Yeah. The definition between the two sects is not as big as you might think it is. The differences between the Sunni and the Shia are more pronounced when it comes to theology or to the structure of the religious institutions. There are some differences in law, and because the main reason for the differences that do exist is that the Shia actually never did close the door to ijtihad. The Shia being more hierarchically structured, whereas in Sunni Islam follows sort of like the the general sciences in terms of who constitutes a scholar. In the West, you can be an astronomer because you got a PhD in astronomy from a recognized institution, or because you've done work that other astronomers recognize and respect. And so similarly, among the Sunnis, one becomes a mujtahid because one has done work that is respected by other people considered to be mujtahids. Among the Shias, it's more like the Western model of medicine, where it doesn't matter how well you know medicine. If you have not gotten approval by the AMA, you are not a doctor. You can't use that. You can't hang up that shingle. So they have their union of teachers who decide who is called a mujtahid, and they have different degrees of mujtahids. At the highest level, at the lowest level, one is able to make a fatwa or a legal opinion binding only on oneself. And then at the highest level, someone like Ayatollah Khomeini could have made a fatwa binding on everybody. So, because of this structural difference, the Shias always had engaged in ijtihad continuously, and therefore you will find, if you look to the answer questions that are considered to be modern questions, biological issues, modern fertilization procedures are acceptable, and so on, that you'll find that they're much more sophisticated in their understanding of these issues and on the opinions that they issue, that they put forward. Whereas among the Sunnis, you find the level is not quite so impressive, because they're basically just starting to wrestle with these issues as they revive ijtihad in the Sunni world. I would imagine the same thing is true of intellectual property rights laws, but I have to say here, I do not know much about what the Shia view on intellectual property rights laws are. In preparing for this presentation, I focused on Egypt to try to make the study tractable so that I could get some kind of decent handle on one example of intellectual property rights law in the modern Muslim world.
Great. Well, thank you. And Dr. Greenberg, I want to ask you a question and then flip it over to Dr. Ahmad. And when it comes to IP law, let's just say in the United States, and based on the beliefs and precepts and assumptions we have behind it, and we've enshrined initiative and ownership and all that, what's the mechanism for resolving regulatory conflict? So, I'll make this up. This isn't a real example, but if we grant ownership rights to a creator of digital content or whatever artistic content for what it is 70 years or 75 years, whatever, and well, we do business with countries that have different definitions of that ownership and those rights, most notably China. What are the mechanisms for us, from a legal or a regulatory perspective, to reconcile those, not just differences of legal opinion, but differences of legal opinion that are derived from differences in beliefs? Is there some latitude that exists in the Western, in the U.S. framework or Western framework more broadly for, if you will, compromise or exceptions? And up to a point where it violates some fundamental red line on belief, or is it just simply fungible and dependent on circumstance? I want to understand because I want Dr. Ahmad to talk about what level of compromise is possible, what is allowable by the FIC in similar circumstances when IP schemes might not match. It's a really long question, but do you get where I'm trying to go with it, Michael?
I think so. So I think that what you're pointing at is that we live in a world where international commerce is incredibly intense and fast-paced, and where the fact that we have one set of rules and specific underlying assumptions for IP protection in the United States, that's wonderful, but we're constantly interacting with people from countries from all over the world whose IP protection rules may differ from ours in greater or lesser degree. So the question becomes, what exactly does that mean? How do we make sure that when we're doing business overseas, we're protected, or at least we understand the rules of the road elsewhere, and how similar are the different IP regimes in different places? And then I think on top of that, you're also asking, what does the U.S. government do in order to try to achieve some degree of harmony with the beliefs and contours of IP protection elsewhere? I believe it's the case that there are several international treaties that have been developed over time and signed off on by lots of countries internationally in order to try to move toward some level of consensus around some basic definitions or understandings about both what the contours of intellectual property law and what kind of enforcement ought to take place. Certainly not to the degree that everybody has the same system or that everybody shares the same principles, but I think there has been some aim to try to move things in the direction where there's at least on paper some shared international consensus around the basic idea that intellectual property protection is a good thing and that intellectual property rights ought to be enforced. That's part of the answer, and I think that also dovetails with another part of the answer, which is that if you're in the United States and you're going to write a book or a piece of software or you're going to invent something, so you're either going to be trying to copyright or to patent the thing, whatever that is, your first step is probably going to be to copyright it or patent it here in the United States. And that gives you a certain set of rights and protections and recourse to the legal system in the United States if somebody steals your thing. If you know that you're immediately going to be going overseas, whether it's to Europe or to Asia or to some particular country, and that you're going to be selling your book or your invention in this overseas country, your lawyer is likely to tell you, hey, if we know what country that is, we should go over there and we should register for the whatever the analogous kind of IP protection would be under that country's regime. So you could apply for patent rights or whatever the equivalent of that is in Europe or Asia in the particular markets you think you're going to access. That's going to give you greater or lesser protection, and it's going to mean that you have to get your head around exactly what the laws of the other jurisdiction are and what kind of enforcement capability is there. But that's, I think, a part of the practical approach that people who have an immediate commercial need to try to protect their property, that's part of what it is that they wind up doing in order to try to do that.
Okay, and I want to build on that. And Dr. Ahmad, before you jump in, I actually got another question on the my email here that was building on Dr. Reinbert's thinking, and I'll read it to you in part, and then again, you're welcome to answer it or give me a better understanding of the topic if it's not answerable. And this is coming from somebody who does based in the U.S. who does work in Muslim countries. And his point is that he believes that they Muslim countries have different ideas behind IP. And for instance, what we consider IP piracy seems to be sometimes a best practice. But is that because it's typically something that we encounter in the developing world from a civil perspective, or because it's something deriving from a different definition within Islamic law? I think I get what he's getting at there. Does that help build upon?
Let me separate my comment on what Dr. Bloomberg just said and this question, because I think it's helpful in addressing the issue about how in practice you're going to deal with IP issues to look at two facts. One is among the Sunni schools, and I want to emphasize that we call Sunni Islam, and about 85 to 90% of the Muslims are Sunnis, is actually four different schools of thought that early on in Muslim history agreed to recognize legitimacy of one another. So although they may differ on important issues of law, they nonetheless acknowledge that the other schools are within the framework of legitimate Islamic interpretation. And as a result, when two people, for example, maybe who belong to two different Sunni schools, make a contract, they can specify within the contract which of the schools they're going to follow in terms of resolution of contract disputes. Furthermore, the importance of contract in Islamic law in general cannot be, possibly be overstated. It is absolutely essential that contracts be observed and followed. And thus, any legitimate contract, any contract that is not an agreement to do something that is itself illegal, like say for a contract, a murder contract or something like that, must be enforced as agreed to by the parties. And this idea of the legitimacy of contracts is also carried over into treaties, and therefore, when it comes to highly disputed issues like intellectual property rights, the mere fact that you have a treaty to which the subscribing states have agreed to govern the intellectual property rights issue in that particular area means that you have legitimacy under Islamic law to abide by that. Now, moving on to the question that was just asked, why this can still remain to be a problem is, of course, the boundary line of, well, what is it that is absolutely prohibited? If you have if a country enters into a treaty to engage in mass murder, no Muslim will say that treaty has to be observed. Similarly, most Muslims would be opposed to agreements that have to do with what's called riba, or let's say gambling, or something like that. And the question becomes: well, are there some intellectual property rights that are outside of what is protected by protectable under Islamic law? And here, the debates you're going to get into, I find, are very similar to the debates that you've seen in the West over these things. After all, patents are a monopoly grant. And in Islamic law, there is a great hostility to monopolies in general. And artificial monopolies would be very, very difficult to defend. Now, is there a method by which they can be defended nonetheless? The answer is yes. We go back to that toolbox of ijtihad that I referred to earlier, and I didn't specify what some of the tools are, but let me do so now. The traditional tools include things like analogy. If something is allowed or prohibited clearly, and you can make an analogy to something new that has not, come up before, then you can decide whether it's prohibited or allowed by analogy. You can use logical deduction. You can use considerations of equity. You can use public interest. You can always argue necessity. And there's also something called juristic preference that has to do really with the opinion of the jurist in a particular case. All of these are valid tools of ijtihad, and all of these come into play when the arguments are brought forth in favor of intellectual property rights. So let's take an easy case, which is, the case of copyright. Under Islamic law, the worker is entitled to the fruits of his labor. And when it comes to material goods, this is very obvious and self-evident. But it turns out that when it came even to questions of immaterial goods, where the argument has been made both under Islam and in the West, that the fact that I have the right to something that is immaterial, I am not deprived of my use of that by someone else's use of it. That has been used as an objection to copyright. However, we find that the early fuqaha, that's the jurists, that they decided that that pre-Islamic law that gave the right of ownership to a poem to the poet who wrote it was valid and legitimate and protected the rights of the poet. And therefore, they established, they didn't call it copyright, of course, but it was the equivalent of copyright, in which the poet had the right to license his poetry and to be compensated when other people made use of it. Whatever it was called, this is clearly the antecedent of modern copyright, and therefore provides an argument for the legitimacy of copyrights. patents are a little more tricky. Even in the United States, the people who put patent protection into the Constitution intended it to only be a short-term thing, because when you're talking about patents, of course, you're talking about discoveries as much as you are talking about inventions. And the question is, you know, and instead, public interest has been appealed to in the constitutional, and here I'm talking about American constitutional argument for granting of patents, that it is in the public interest in order to encourage people to come up with inventions by artificially giving them a limited monopoly rights period over it in which they would benefit from the licensing. And therefore, that same argument could be used under public interest, and has been used under public interest under Islamic law. Of course, different people are going to disagree about how long the patent should be for, under the exact terms under which it can be applied. For example, it is an interesting item in Egyptian law, which does recognize patents, but which says that if someone else had already commercially exploited an invention before the patent was granted, you cannot deprive that person from their continued use of their own invention, although you could limit them in the licensing, prevent them from interfering with the licensing rights of the patent holder. Now, that raises questions in my own mind about why would you even grant a patent to someone when someone else had already made a commercial development of it. But again, I'm not a patent attorney, so I'll just set that aside as an interesting question and say this is an example of the kind of agreements that one can come to. And then finally, because of this respect for contracts and for treaties, once you have, and of course I mentioned consensus, if you have in a Muslim country that there has been a consensus that they will grant intellectual property rights of a certain kind, then it, by the right of consensus, becomes part of the Islamic law. And then by agreement of treaty with other countries, it would have to be respected across borders for those inventions, you know, within a particular country. So if the United States has a treaty with, let's say, Indonesia, and the United States has granted a patent to somebody, and under the treaty with Indonesia, that patent must be respected, then under Islamic law, that patent must be respected by the Indonesians who have agreed to it.
Wow, this is fascinating, because, and by the way, just for clarification, so when you said you thought you looked particularly at Egypt, just to prep a little bit for this conversation, Egypt is Sunni, is that correct?
That's right.
And is Pakistan also Sunni? Also correct. Like you said, 80% to 90%. It's most often not these Islamic countries.
The main Shia countries are Iran, Bahrain, and arguably Lebanon, and of course Iraq.
Got it.
Although Iraq has a huge Sunni population.
Yep. And again, Dr. Rieberg, I want you to jump in a second here, but I just wanted to add what I find so fascinating about Dr. Ahmad's observation is, you know, when I think back to the FIC in America, which arguably starts with the Constitution, copyright is like one of the first things that gets addressed and granted in that document, if I'm not mistaken. I think we even left creating a judicial system to enforce and interpret the Constitution came after granting copyright in the foundational document. That speaks to, I think, a point you touched on, Dr. Greenberg, at the beginning of the show about how there is a Western canon on ownership and rights granted, whether material or intangible, that seems somewhat, if not very different from what Dr. Ahmad's talking about in terms of the general reticence or discomfort with how closely that starts to look like monopoly and that idea of control versus there being this open negotiated, you know, contractual understanding between parties. This idea of granting rights, you know, in perpetuity or for some grand amount of time, is something the West takes for granted and something that the FIC isn't necessarily as comfortable with, though it respects it and can, you know, negotiate, but it's not the same thing. Do you have a follow-on for Dr. Ahmad on that or just some thoughts about, am I right on my Constitution, by the way?
I have to go back to the Constitution to make sure, but it sounds right to me, Jonathan. I think I'm struck in what Dr. Mott's been saying by the resonance that I've heard with underlying strands of debate, certainly in the United States or more broadly in the West, around what the right contours of intellectual property protection should be. Because Dr. Ahmad's absolutely right. There is that kind of embedded weird contradiction in patent of granting monopoly rights. And, when you sort of drill down to, well, why would we do that or why do we do that? It's because of an underlying belief that notwithstanding the fact that we are granting limited monopoly rights, we nevertheless think that that foundation is what allows an efficient market system to develop around grabbing innovations and actually leveraging them in a way that forces them out and allows society to fully benefit from them. So there is this weird idea that if you had a world where you had no such protection and therefore nobody could actually rely on having a protected property interest in some innovative something that they came up with, then people would have much, much less incentive to go out and actually try to do creative and innovative things, and the ability of the market to take those things and push them out and allow others to benefit from them would be attenuated. Now, I'm not saying that I necessarily have a strong point of view about that, but that whole set of arguments about around conceptually what's the right balance to strike is kind of tied up in the intellectual property institutions that we've developed. And I think a part of what Dr. Ahmad said was that it's within the scope of the FIC and the debate and logic among Muslim law scholars. It's well within that evolving community of thought to sort of have some of these same arguments in trying to figure out what contours for something like patent actually would be appropriate and consistent with sort of a Muslim law perspective, an Islamic law perspective on this same IP protection regime. Clearly, in some ways, we're approaching these questions from different places, but it doesn't feel to me like it's a completely qualitatively unrelated conceptual discussion that's being had in the West versus in the Islamic context, at least based on what we just discussed.
Well, if I may make an observation,
please.
You commented about the copyright appearing in the Constitution. I think it's valuable to reflect on the fact that copyright tenure was originally much, much shorter than it is now,
true.
And that it got extended and then extended again and extended again. Most recently, trying to remember. I know in the 1970s it got extended to the life of the author plus 50 years, but I know when I first copyrighted my first work, I think it was for 14 years and 14 years renewable. So clearly, this question of balance is something that is still hotly debated, and I have to begin to question when the tenure of the copyright is much longer than the lifetime of the children or the author, whether the balance has been tilted too far in one direction.
Yeah, no, and a great point. And actually, and that gets to my last question that I want to pose to you, Dr. Ahmad, and I want you to sort of put your prognosticator hat on and think, a bit long term here, in that you talked a lot, and I think very compellingly, about the diverse evolution that the FIC has taken over the centuries, and that a lot of the civil structures that had bits and pieces of Western colonialism or simply just Western thinking sort of interwoven into the civil authorities in the emergent countries in the Islamic world, whether that was hegemonic or not, it just simply was and is. Do you see going forward a process where the civil regulations on IP and other trade-related issues in terms of intangible assets in particular. Is there a sort of these are all the wrong words, but a clarification or a re-Islamification or a purifying, if you will, in sort of getting a fic that is closer and closer, or a civil scheme that is closer to a genuine sort of unaffected or uncolored version of the fic? And if so, does that in fact perhaps empower Islamic countries to better engage in negotiation and in treaties and in understanding of these shared principles of copyright and IP? Or does that make the premise of cooperation perhaps more difficult over time? Or is the entire premise of my question crazy?
No, actually, I think it's a very profound question and a very good one. I would say that I would point out that when you look at the early era of Islamic development and the suddenness with which the Islamic civilization became the premier civilization on earth, remember that Muhammad received his revelations in the early 7th century. By the 9th century, the Islamic civilization was the primary civilization on earth. From that time until about the at least the 13th century, most of the scientific progress was coming out of the Muslim world, and most trade was being conducted in and through the Muslim world. All of this was helped, not hurt, by the fact that the Muslim empire, as it expanded so quickly, interacted with the cultures that it came into contact with. The Muslims never automatically rejected the ideas that they encountered as they came into North Africa, as they came into Persia, as they came into Greece. They never rejected those ideas, but rather they interacted with them and evaluated them from within the Islamic context, and thus they were able to not only preserve the scientific ideas of ancient Greece, but actually to advance upon them. So the same thing, I think, holds true now when Muslim countries interact with conceptions of intellectual property rights that are coming out of the West, including new technologies. It's interesting, for example, if we compare the Egyptian copyright law and the American copyright law, and we look at the differences come not so much from the Islamic background of Egypt, but from the French model that imposed on Egypt. In other words, when you look at Egyptian law and you say it differs from American law, those differences mainly reflect the differences between French law and American law. And therefore, putting it back into an Islamic context and conversation allows Egypt to consider, well, should we perhaps be more like American law in order to be more authentically Islamic? And I think that that's a very profound question, and I think that shows that what we have here is an opportunity for the Muslim countries to improve on what they inherited from the colonial powers that were there previously.
Well, and that is a wonderfully encouraging point, at which I have to say that an hour has passed, though it seemed only like minutes. And we're at the end of our conversation here, and I want to thank both of my guests today, Dr. Michael Greenberg, Rand Corporation, and also a member of the Society's Reputation Leadership Council, and Dr. Imad Adin Ahmad, president of the Minaret of Freedom Institute, an Islamic think tank. And again, I encourage you to visit his website. There's a lot of fascinating content there. I'd also like to recognize and thank Michael Moberly of KP Strat for developing this and all of our other programs. And also thanks to all of you for listening, and especially to those of you who gave me some really good questions to ask. I'm sorry I didn't get to all of them, but I really appreciate your contributions. Now, before we conclude, I want to do a little commercial here about what's coming up next. And I'd like to invite all of you to our next Mission Intangible monthly briefing, about which I'm very excited. Brazil, the lead emerging market among the four horsemen, including Russia, India, and China, the BRICS, is being shunned by investors. Is it a new world for a former recent darling? Speaking on the intangibles of value in Brazil on March 28th at 10 a.m. Eastern will be Jose Roberto Martins, founder and CEO of Global Brands in São Paulo, Brazil. And then in April, we know that fiat money is currency that a government has declared to be legal tender. its value is intangible and not backed by a physical commodity. We use this stuff every day. What about fiat money that has no government declaration? On April 18th, again at 10 a.m. Eastern, Ken Cox, VP of Operations at Hosterion.com, will talk about Bitcoin, the ultimate intangible. And then, just to give you the long term, halfway to summer on May 16th at 10 a.m. Eastern, John Kepler, an IP attorney, will talk about intangibles of intangibles, quality assurance and quality control of intellectual property. Now, in the meantime, if you have an idea for a future program topic or you have thoughts on people with whom we should talk, including yourself, please shoot us an email at questions@iafinance.com. Again, thank you for your time today, and thank you to my great both doctors here. I feel smarter. Thank you so much for your time, and I will look forward to talking to all of you next month. Bye-bye.